Welcome to Rings of Power Reactions. I'm Aaron, your host and fellow Middle-earth wanderer. Here you'll find reviews, reactions, and deep dives into the lore behind Amazon Prime's Rings of Power. To go deeper, come wander with me on my main podcast, Lore of the Rings. Visit ringspodcast.com or find Lore of the Rings on your favorite podcast player. Now, let's wander Rings of Power. Every holiday season, we gather around the stories that matter, stories that endure. And what better way to carry those stories with you than with a ring inspired by Tolkien's Legendarium? Manly Bands has created the official Lord of the Rings collection, each piece designed with the care and detail you'd expect from a world that has shaped our imaginations for generations. I wear the Aragorn ring. It reminds me daily of strength, hope, and timeless courage. To find your exclusive discount code for 25% off your Manly Band, visit ringspodcast.com and tap the gold bar at the top. This holiday, give something that lasts longer than a season. That's ringspodcast.com and tap the gold bar. From orc babies to Numenorean political chaos, Rings of Power takes us where Tolkien never did. I'm Aaron, your guide to wandering Middle-earth. Today we explore the third episode of Season 2, The Eagle and the Scepter of Amazon Prime's Rings of Power. We have so much lore to cover in this episode and in the future Rings of Power episodes, so make sure you hit that subscribe button so that you don't miss out on wandering with me. And a hobbit-sized pint for this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to join the Wandering Fellowship, head over to ringspodcast.com/donate to find a membership that fits you. Now, let's wander. In this episode, Beric and Isildur are reunited, Annatar tries to convince Celebrimbor to make more rings, Numenor experiences political unrest in the wake of the fallen soldiers and dead king. Who will lead Numenor now? This episode opens with a few minutes from Season 1, when Elendil lets Beric the Horse go after the battle in the Southlands. Where does the horse go? Well, first he returns to a village, but gets waylaid by orcs. The orcs say something disturbing here, that they won't eat the horse until later. Do orcs eat horses? Let me remind you of this line from The Hobbit. I know, we don't quote The Hobbit nearly enough, but today we will. After Bilbo and the dwarves have been captured under the mountain, their ponies are pushed into a corner, and we read that, quote, "Goblins eat horses, and ponies, and donkeys, and other much more dreadful things, and they are always hungry." So that's an affirmative on that one. However, the orcs don't follow the horse because he goes into the Black Forest. Is the Black Forest a real place? I can't find a Black Forest in Middle-earth, so this appears to be a Rings of Power invention. The cave that Beric runs into, however, is very real, because I believe this cave, full of spiders in the mountains above Mordor, is meant to be none other than Shelob's cave. Shelob, for a reminder, is the name of the spider monster creature that captures Frodo in Return of the King. And yes, Shelob indeed inhabited that cave at the time of the Second Age. Now, I am in general not a fan of spider scenes in TV shows. I just don't like spiders. But there is one shot that I thought was really great. When Isildur attempts to throw the spider off his back, the spider hangs on, but just a little bit, and redirects the momentum to hit Isildur back down. That makes my stomach lurch. I thought it was great. We finally return to Numenor. These are the first shots of Numenor in Season 2, and I think we are just not getting enough of Numenor. Numenor is one of the primary stories of the Second Age of Middle-earth, and I just think it's not getting enough attention. It just seems so short and hurried. Ironic when you consider that Numenor was supposed to be a place for mortal man to experience an extended natural life, and perhaps slow down to enjoy paradise a little. Let's get back to the scene. I'm not up to speed on all the details of Numenorean burial rites for nobility, if Tolkien wrote any, but I feel the seashell thing was a nice touch. Fits with the idea of Numenor being a seafaring kingdom. Elendil says an interesting thing here, that the previous king protected the faithful. Who are the faithful? Now, Rings of Power totally skipped over this, but the movement of the faithful was a key pillar of Numenor's downfall, or rather a reaction to the ideas that brought about Numenor's downfall. In Numenor, mortal men began to be jealous of the immortal elves, and their jealousy in time grew to a great enmity. Hence the sundering of Numenoreans and the elves that we see in Rings of Power. However, there were some in Numenor who still wanted to cultivate a friendship with the elves, and in particular were obedient to the commandments of the one creator god Ilúvatar. Hence, they were called the Faithful. Elendil was the last of the Faithful, and with his two sons, they led the survivors of Numenor's downfall and established kingdoms in Middle-earth. For a refresher on this tale, check out Lore of the Rings episodes 34, 36, and 38 at ringspodcast.com. There's a quick cutscene to remind us that Elendil's daughter, Eärien, briefly had access to the palantir that Queen Meriel showed Galadriel in Season 1. We're introduced to a new noble of northern Numenor. Wow, say that five times fast. Lord Belzegar, who is another Rings of Power invention. But I think we find here another biblical allusion, as Belzegar sounds to my ears an awful lot like Beelzebub, a name for Satan in the Bible. So this guy is up to no good. Meriel mentions that an eagle attended her father's coronation. What is the history of eagles at Numenor? To break that down, let's remind ourselves of what the eagles represent. The eagles are the chief servants of Manwë, the High King of the Valar. The Valar are the divine guardians of Middle-earth who dwell in the undying lands of Valinor. The eagles bring news to Manwë, and sometimes act as his heralds to the people of Middle-earth, as would be the case with an eagle attending a coronation. In Unfinished Tales, Tolkien wrote about a sacred mountain on Numenor. The summit was an open flat space, generally available for anyone to ascend to. Quote, "If anyone approached the summit, at once three eagles would appear and alight upon the three rocks near the western edge. They were called the Witnesses of Manwë." I don't have a reference for if an eagle ever graced the coronation of a king or queen of Numenor, but it would appear the showrunners are using this bit of lore as inspiration for the final scene of this episode, but more on that later. Now there's a scene of some political maneuvering happening in a bar. The first thing I'll say here is that Lord Belzegar is a creepy old man. But really what I want to point out is this. Keep your eyes open for potential ring bearers for the 9 rings that will be given to mortal men. We know that at least 3 of these rings were worn by Numenoreans. Don't ask me where that reference is because I can't remember it. But as I look at this bar scene, I'm wondering if both Cayman, he's the haughty aristocrat son of Pharazôn, and Valandil, the soldier who was a friend to Isildur, I wonder if they are both contenders for future ring bearers. They may seem to be on different sides now, but I could see a character arc that would have them each take up a ring, hoping for his own rise to power, only to become a servant to Lord Sauron. And since we're mentioning it, let's throw Lord Beelzebub from Numenor and Theo from the Southlands on that list of potential bearers of 9 rings, so keep an eye out for those. Okay, back to Mordor, where Adar and the orcs are preparing for war, even though the orcs seem unwilling to do so. And then we see an orc baby. Okay, let's talk orc babies. When I first saw this, I was like, okay, I did not need to see that. In one way, it makes sense. If orcs are corrupted elves, then sure, why not? In fact, there's a line from Tolkien's The Silmarillion, quote, "For the orcs had life and multiplied after the manner of the children of Ilúvatar." Ah, there's an Ilúvatar reference. Ilúvatar is the creator god over all who created all things, such as the Valar that I mentioned earlier. Ilúvatar's children are specifically elves and men. So if orcs multiply in similar fashion to the children of Ilúvatar, that is, elves and men, then sure, they have orc babies. But Tolkien didn't really give any more details than that. Not that I'm aware of, at least. And there's not a lot to suggest that orcs lived in nuclear family units, and that their fathers were particularly paternal in their dedication to their children. I guess you've got Azog, the so-called pale orc from The Hobbit, and his son Bolg. Theirs is not exactly the kind of relationship I want with my two sons, but hey, I try not to be an orc, and I guess I'm all for TV shows portraying actually loving, engaging, dedicated fathers. I think that's a positive thing that we need to see more of in TV shows. But it seems that Rings of Power is really determined to make us empathize with the orcs. Rather than the orcs being mindless killing machines in service of evil, Rings of Power is really trying hard to add some depth and emotional complexity to orcs. Meh, okay, not sure why we need that, especially considering how easily and quickly Rings of Power glosses over and stereotypes the other species of Middle-earth that I would much rather explore. And I think it misses some of the key points of Tolkien lore and why he wrote these stories in the first place. Beauty, light, sub-creation, Arda perfected, death, the fall, etc. I'm not going to get into all of that here, though. And besides, this isn't the last baby that we'll see in this episode, although you may not have caught it. Adar welcomes a troll, naming him Demrod, the hill troll of Arid Mithrin, killer of stone giants and eater of dragon bones. Is this a canon troll or Rings of Power invention? Well, there is a Damrod in Lord of the Rings, but he's a man, not a troll, so Troll Damrod is a Rings of Power invention. However, Arid Mithrin is a real place. These are the Grey Hills, way up in the northeast of Middle-earth, farther north than Mirkwood and the Lonely Mountain, and to the east of the Misty Mountains. And stone giants are certainly lore. Here we go back to The Hobbit. I know, twice in one episode, quote, Bilbo saw that across the valley the stone giants were out, and were hurling rocks at one another for a game. Now, are these stone giants literally giant creatures made of stone, like what we see in the first Hobbit film? Who's to say? We don't get a lot more detail than that. And if Damrod the troll indeed eats dragon bones, then he must be formidable. Plus, that matches with his geographic origins, with the dragons being all up north. Let's note an on-screen adaptation difference here. This troll is different from Peter Jackson's trolls, which were pretty much low-intelligence creatures acting on instinct. Rather, Damrod speaks in full sentences and with proper grammar, more like the trolls from The Hobbit that turned to stone. Boom, three Hobbit references. We're going there and back again today. Well, and to Damrod's question, where is Sauron indeed? He's in Eregion, where Durin and Disa have accepted the invitation to talk with Celebrimbor. The Durin-Disa relationship is still compelling to watch. The little eye rolls are just so awesome to me. Annatar seems to brood in the background, stepping in only when necessary to keep the manipulation rolling. Behind them, you can see the forge is already being set up to create seven rings. Okay, so why seven rings for the dwarves? That's easy. To match the seven houses of the dwarves. Here's a harder one. Why seven houses of dwarves? Let's go back. Way back. Further back than even before the elves and men had awoken. One of the Valar, those divine guardians of Middle-earth, got a little excited about the children of Iluvatar, and set to doing a little crafting of his own. This was Aule, and so, quote, he made first the seven fathers of the dwarves in a hall under the mountains of Middle-earth. Now, in watching this episode, I was struck by something. Those of us who have read the lore were freaking out quite a bit when the three elven rings were created in Season 1, because sequentially, those were the last rings of power crafted by Celebrimbor. The other rings came first. Crafting order aside, the rings were not actually made for the different species on purpose. They were more crafted as sets that Sauron then stole and handed out to dwarves and men. But as I saw the forge for the seven rings and heard the theme of the ringverse being overlaid in this scene, I realized something. Rings of Power is following the sequence of the rings as it is laid out in the ringverse. Quote, three rings for the elven kings under the sky, seven for the dwarf lords in their halls of stone, nine for mortal men doomed to die. So while Rings of Power is not following the lore as written in the Silmarillion or the appendices, they are following the order as it is written in the ringverse. I only just realized that as I saw the forge set up to create seven rings, after the mixing of the three. Look closely at the forge and you'll see what I mean. But I still think it's really dumb that the foundational assumption of Rings of Power is that Mithril is a miracle drug that cures all troubles in Middle-earth. Therefore, make all the rings for Mithril and all your troubles be gone. I think that's elevating Mithril to a much higher place than Tolkien intended, and turns it into a sort of panacea that negates all other efforts for light to prevail over darkness. Annatar continues his manipulation of the peoples of Middle-earth, locking into Durin's weak points, and then giving half-truths and insinuations to subtly nudge Celebrimbor to cut off all communication with King Gil-galad. In this conversation, Celebrimbor gives us some dialogue that calls up some Peter Jackson film scenes for me. The first is when he says, quote, what business is it of his how I conduct myself in my own realm? That reminds me of Bilbo in his struggle to give up the One Ring, and he tells Gandalf, quote, what business is it of yours what I do with my own things? This is telling because it shows how even the thought of these rings brings out the child's selfishness in these characters. Next, Celebrimbor says, quote, we have not the time to bandy words about, convincing him who is worthy of aid. That calls to my mind the words of Gandalf to Wormtongue in Rohan when he says, quote, I have not crossed through fire and death to bandy crooked words with a witless worm. If only Celebrimbor could have had that same attitude towards Annatar. Both those lines, by the way, are nearly exactly as Tolkien wrote them, So I would say stick with the dialogue that Tolkien wrote. Don't deviate from it, and you will have amazing dialogue. But please, please, please stop with the supposing. Could we not come up with some different ways to say that? It's really distracting to me. But you know what is not a distraction? Is if you open up your podcast player right now, tap that share button, and send a link to this episode to a friend of yours. Supposing you shared this episode, and supposing they opened it, and supposing they listened to the episode, then supposing you talked about it with them, well then we wouldn't have to suppose anymore. You would be wandering Middle-earth together. I suppose that would be fun, but I digress, supposedly. Isildur is traveling through the desolate lands of Mordor on his way to Pelargir. The lands subtly change around him, so some good visual storytelling here, as the leaves change from ashen and white to having some color. He scavenges some boots and a sword. Interesting that when he comes across the ravaged camp, there's a Numenorean soldier dead against a tree with three arrows in his chest. It reminds me of Boromir, who had three arrows in the Fellowship film, although I think the book says only many without a specific number. The land that they travel through is the beautiful narrow strip of land between Mordor and the Anduin River known as Ithilien. It's not named that now, of course, because the name comes from Isildur himself, who will build his tower nearby after the downfall of Sauron. I did a great breakdown of that and how the word Ithil, or Isildur's name, is tied with the moon, while his brother's name and associated tower are connected to the sun. Check out episode 66 of Lore of the Rings for that tale at ringspodcast.com/66. And Arondir is back, with his Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles moves and a final kill shot at one who got away that would make Buddy the Elf proud. At Pelargir, Arondir is mourning the death of his romantic interest, Bronwyn. There's just one thing interesting here that I want to call out. He seems hesitant to actually set the flame to the funeral pyre. This speaks to me of how the elves really could not understand the death of mortal man. How foreign of a phenomena it is to him. But let's take a moment to think about Pelargir. This was a coastal city built over 2,000 years into the Second Age, and became a haven for the faithful, those in Numenor who stayed true to the elves and the Valar. In fact, Pelargir is the landing place for Elendil after the drowning of Numenor, so stay tuned for that. In Khazad-dûm, Durin seeks to reconcile with his father and brings him the ring's proposal. My kids love the dwarf guards. They think the beard masks make them look fierce. Their word, not mine. The Dwarven King gives a line that is a callback to Legolas speaking to Aragorn in the Two Towers film. You look terrible. We go back to Pelargir for just a moment where Arondir mentions Beleriand. He says that it was an entire elf realm. I think that sells it short. Beleriand was an entire continent, upon which the main events of the First Age of Middle-earth played out. And at the end of the First Age, was nearly entirely sunk into the sea. We join Isildur and Theo on a side quest to save Beric the horse. In the forest, keep track of the sound of chopping wood during this scene, and notice the woman holding a baby. The wild men accuse Theo and his people of attacking three of their camps. That reminds me of my fourth Hobbit reference for today, when Thorin and the dwarves were trying to rest by a fire in the forest, and the elves keep packing up and leaving each time, and eventually accuse the dwarves of party crashing during their feast three times. But was it indeed the survivors at Pelargir who attacked the camps? Or perhaps it was something else. Something that really hates axes. That's it for the Pelargir storyline for this episode, but we still have a coronation to get to. We'll explore that right after this break. We're not done yet. If you like this episode, please leave a review and share with your friends. And remember to subscribe if you haven't already. We'll be right back. Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the First Age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide. We return to Numenor, where Muriel is about to take up the scepter of Numenor. Quick call out, in Numenor, the ruling power was symbolized not by the wearing of a crown, but rather the holding of the royal scepter. If you look closely in the Return of the King film, you can see that Denethor, the steward of Gondor, is often holding a scepter or has one nearby. Denethor's scepter is not the same as the Numenorean scepter, but it follows the same tradition of Denethor's Numenorean ancestors. Muriel's speech here was kind of meh for me. It really didn't inspire a lot of emotion, but it was an excellent setup for Muriel's political enemies to make a move, so I guess the screenwriters had to keep it in. Elendil's daughter reveals the Palantir, thinking that its presence will delegitimize Muriel's claim to the throne. Farazan has orchestrated this entire drama to force Muriel's hand in confessing that she is faithful to the elves and their gifts. Elendil attempts to handle the Palantir with bare hands and suffers an explosive fate a la Aragorn did in the Return of the King film. We need to explore the eagle scene because I think this is being wildly misunderstood and is somewhat of a controversy. First, remember what I mentioned about eagles earlier. They are witnesses of Manwë and his special servants, and are therefore taken as omens that the Valar are pleased with certain actions, or even as warnings. Now, the controversial bit here is that after the eagle shows up at the coronation, Lord Belzegar leads the people in chanting Farazan's name, interpreting the eagle to be a sign that the Valar want Farazan to be king. Such a sign would be an incredible diverging breach of lore, the likes of which would simply outdo almost any lore deviations that have been infracted so far. But I don't think this is the case. I think the eagle's behavior reveals its intentions. When looking at Muriel, the eagle is at peace. It is regal and gentle. That speaks to me of acceptance and blessing. However, as Farazan gets closer, the eagle grows from agitated to fierce before leaving. This communicates to me that the eagle does not choose Farazan. However, with some well-timed mob action, Lord Beelzebub seizes the opportunity to turn the people against Muriel and towards Farazan. But if only the people stopped and thought about this for a moment. They are choosing Farazan, the leader of defiance against the powers in the West, the Valar, and their sign that he should be their king is the eagle sent from those powers in the West? That is gaslighting of the highest degree. Yet Farazan's defiant approach to the eagle is a foreshadowing. His pride will lead him to defiantly approach the very undying lands themselves, and single-handedly bring down the greatest nation of men on Middle-earth. One last scene before this episode closes. Seven rings are crafted for the dwarves, complete with mithril from their own mountain. But it is not Celebrimbor who adds the final ingredient, but rather Annatar, who seems to add his own blessing, if you will, to the mithril and the creation of the rings, a fact that is not lost on Durin the Younger or a very awkward-looking Celebrimbor. Let's score this episode on the Lord of the Rings patented 5 wizard staff scale. Again, remember 5 is totally amazing, absolutely over-the-top perfect, and 1 being absolutely terrible. Okay, story. I'm going to go with a 2 on this one. I don't feel like a whole lot happened to really move the story forward, except for a few highlights that could have been more deeply explored. Characters, 4, I am enjoying seeing the growth of Durin and his father and Isildur, and a little bit in Theo as well. Dialogue, uninspiring speeches, weird phrasing, and the overused supposing, I just can't. But with some Tolkien-inspired gems, though not enough to pull this one up for me, I'm giving it a 2. Visuals, 5, I've been pretty consistent here, but nearly every scene is a feast for the eyes, and again, go look at the forge as it's set up to create the 7 rings. It's almost as if there's 3 pools, and then they kind of go down to the 7, connecting the 7 rings back to the 3 rings. I think there's some visual storytelling going on there, so 5 for this one. Music, I did notice Durin's theme popping up in different ways to reveal his internal emotions, and I will say that it was the music, along with the visual storytelling looking at the forge, that really clued me into the rings verse, so I'm going to give it a 5. Lore faithfulness. I'm giving this one a 2. I don't think we needed orc babies. The eagle scene could be a major misinterpretation from my part. Sheetlime's Lair was a nice touch, and the ring verse ordering was good, so maybe I could go a 3 on this, but I'm sticking to a 2. That gives us an overall score of 3.3 for episode 3 of season 2 of Rings of Power. But what did you think? I want to hear from you. Remember to go to ringspodcast.com to send me a voicemail of your thoughts and questions for this episode. Tap the little gray microphone button in the bottom right-hand corner of ringspodcast.com and drop me a line. I may even include your voice in a future episode. Big thank you to this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to support the Lore of the Rings podcast, then head to ringspodcast.com/donate and find a membership that's right for you. Thank you for wandering Middle-earth with me today. My friends, if you enjoyed this episode, let me know by subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing with your friends. Follow me on Facebook or Instagram at Lore of the Rings Podcast. For feedback on the show, please email me using the link in the show notes. Until next Thursday, remember, not all those who wander are lost. Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide.